Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Coming up in this edition of TV Black Box, the cat is out of the bag. We have more information on new shows heading our way in 2024, and the TV networks don't want you to know about them. Plus, the real story behind Peter Hitchener's move from weeknights to weekends on Nine News Melbourne. And a warning, Mulk and I will be picking up where we left off in our little dispute from last week, because there's been a big update on the prominence debate. Warning, warning, watch out. Welcome to the podcast where people in the industry get their news. This is TV Black Box.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is TV Black Box, bringing you the inside goss from the TV industry.
Hello there, welcome to TV Black Box. I'm Rob McKnight, and I am the only person tonight who will not be acknowledging anybody else because it's all about me. Abby Mickelson, TV producer, is here.
Hello, Abby.
Would you like to acknowledge?
Yeah, I actually would, thank you. I am recording on Darramurrugal land tonight and would like to pay my respects to the elders past and present. Wow. It's one thing just to not mention it and not say anything, and it's another to like flat out be like, I will not acknowledge anyone else.
Yeah, that's how it is. Okay. Mulky, come on. Mulky's here. Who would you like to acknowledge? The Academy, the people who, your mum and dad, may her rest in soul.
We had part of that conversation last week, Rob.
That's why I said may she rest in peace. I actually said may she rest in soul. I don't know what I was saying there.
I'm not even sure you know what English is at this point.
No.
I'd like to acknowledge the Darkinjung people, the land on which I live and do a whole bunch of work, and absolutely acknowledge their care for this land for the past thousands and thousands of years. I didn't even know that the cat was in the bag when it comes to anything that TV Black Box talks about, Rob.
Well, we're always taking the cat out of the bag. We swing it around and then we show it to the world.
Well, the TV Black Box does not endorse any kind of violence towards animals.
Speak for yourself. joking.
Jesus, that's twice. Welcome to the show. We are hitting it big.
Non-PC McKnight is tonight. All right. Guys, did you know that we are actually recording this episode of TV Black Box on World Television Day? Back in 1996, the United Nations declared November 21 World Television Day. Now, here's what the official blurb says on why. The UN recognised television as having an increased impact on decision-making as well as being an ambassador for the entertainment industry. Television is a symbol of communication and globalisation that educates, informs, entertains and influences our decisions and opinions. I actually think that's right. We are all very passionate about television here. So on this World Television Day, I thought we would go around the Zoom and find out what everyone loves about television. Abby Mickelson, what do you love about television?
I think that blurb said it really, really well. For me, though, the biggest thing is just the escapism of it. So you can just immerse yourself in whatever world you want to, whatever your mood is. You can go wherever your heart desires, and I love it. And I think that's why also I'm a big rewatcher of shows. I don't often start a new show because I find my comfort in a show. And for me, that is most of the time Gilmore Girls. And I will just rewatch it all the time because that is the world that I want to be transported to. And I just, that's what I love about television, that you can go anywhere and be anywhere you want.
Abby, how would you feel if a theme park, whichever theme park is attached to the studio that owns Gilmore Girls, if they set up like a Gilmore Girls world?
I would be there. I've gone to the Warner Brothers like back lot tour to go to all the houses and stuff,
same.
Which is which is something. I mean, obviously, it's not set up for Gilmore Girls all the time, but it's still it's familiar, and I lost my shit.
Very right.
Yeah. So if there was anything Gilmore Girls themed, I'm there.
And while the Warner Brothers behind the scenes tour isn't like, it's not like kind of renowned like other things to do when you hit LA, it's certainly fun.
It's
like
you every get time to see I've gone to LA, I've done it, and I'll be doing it again next year. It is, it's my, like, probably
there's
my
some fun
top
moments in it, right?
It's so good.
Yeah, you go and look at the friend's couch, go and, you know, be on the road that the Jurassic Park dinosaur come and gets you, come into that town square, which is the centre of just about every town in the history of television and movies. So it's amazing how much they get done on such a small piece of land.
Mm-hmm. One to do indeed. Mark, what would you like to say is fantastic about television?
Television's ability to bring us together, Rob, I think is a thing that, you know, a few mediums are able to do in a way that particularly for big live events where we all tune in to be a part of the thing. And look, the internet age has helped draw us into that. We think of Twitter in its heyday. You know, that really became a massive positive. I need to be on Twitter to engage in the conversation with everybody that's watching this thing with me. And I think that's really good. It's storytelling. The fact that we have seen storytelling grow and develop and birth new storytellers and give creatives a new opportunity because of what television can do and those sorts of things has been phenomenal. And we absolutely benefit both from a global standpoint as much as a parochial local standpoint, seeing and hearing our stories shared with us and told to us to remind us as much as anything that either we can celebrate or be a part of this or be joyous about this or that we can be better or that, you know, there's all different sides to a story that we may not contemplate. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with both of you. I love television for many reasons. It was partly an educator for me. I learned many things that I still use today in my life through television, whether it be the making of TV, and especially Doctor Who.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Not just that, though. That's a very good, obvious one. But even things like, I distinctly remember learning the word eclectic from the movie Sister Act. She says it and explains it.
Great movie.
And I,
not technically television, but I hear you.
It was on TV when I saw it, Mulk.
How very eclectic.
It counts.
But it not only has it been an education tool for me, it's been a companion. It has been something from that I fell in love with and am so thankful that I got to work in the industry, that I'm still working in the industry today. I certainly would like to see the industry thrive and survive. And to hark back to what you said, Mulk, the idea that so many people can come together for one moment, whether it's Kathy Freeman, whether it's the Matildas, whether it's a major news event, a royal wedding, whatever it might be, and even bad events like 9/11, where we're seeing it instantaneously. Nothing beats a picture and the video of being able to see something as it's happening around the world. And that's what television does. And that is why the industry is so important, and especially those news events and those live events. It is of cultural significance, but we will get to that more a little bit later in the show. Meanwhile,
orchestra swells, go to ad break.
Meanwhile, it looks like some new shows are heading our way, and we know about them thanks to casting calls placed by Warner Brothers TV. The first show looks set to be an Australian reboot of Super Nanny, with the ad saying, "We are searching for a nanny, parenting expert or childcare professional who can infuse their experience and wisdom into Australian homes and tackle some of the toughest situations." The next appears to be an Australian adaptation of The Golden Bachelor, which has done very well in the States. The Warner Brothers ad says, "We are looking for fun, active and outgoing male seniors aged 60 or over who are divorced, widowed and open to meeting the next love of their life in our groundbreaking new series. We want to hear from you or anyone who would like to nominate someone they know to take part in the show. We want to celebrate love at every age and show that when it comes to finding love and romance, age is just a number." Abby, great. Golden Bachelor's been a hit. It is a little weird if Channel 10 are going down the path of The Golden Bachelor, considering this is asking for over 60s and Channel 10 is the under 50 demo network.
Yeah, I don't think that will work out very well for them. I mean, The Bachelor itself and The Bachelorette no longer really even appeals to the demo. I think pushing it to an older Bachelor is not going to make any difference. In fact, as someone in that demo, you couldn't pay me to watch The Golden Bachelor, really. Like, it just sounds like my absolute nightmare.
Well, Ten will be pleased, Abby, because The Bachelors is about to premiere.
Yeah. Well, I just, I don't know. I think people are over that franchise as a whole.
You used to watch The Bachelor and The Bachelorette.
I did used to. I would watch it if I was just sitting around with nothing else to do. I would. I wouldn't go, oh, The Bachelor's on at 7:30. I have to sit down on my couch and watch it.
Right.
If I happen to be there and I'm flicking through the channels, I would stop and watch. But overall, I think people are pretty over that franchise as a whole, and I don't think making it someone even older is going to get people back into it, at least young people, if that's what Ten are going for.
Mark, it does seem like a bit of desperate stunt casting. They've seen this work in the States, and I genuinely cannot believe the franchise is still on air in 2023 after how it's been going the last few years.
Yeah, I think... And look, don't quote me on this. And I think Kevin Perry, our editor-in-chief at TV Black Box, certainly had some inside information suggesting that the reason why Ten are continuing to lean into the Bachelor franchise is because it's a condition of their contract with Warner Brothers in them making The Masked Singer. And the challenge for Ten is that they really can't afford no network can afford to make a program that isn't going to rate. They all need everything to do at least a half decent, if not a winning audience.
That is not a contract I would be signing. I think Ten are stupid to say, yeah, I get The Masked Singer, everybody wanted it.
They might not have
had
a choice.
No show is so big that you would sign a contract to do another show that's fucking failing big time.
Yeah, but the problem is if The Masked Singer is doing well for you and for Ten it is doing well, and if they risk not having that format because they won't make the other format. I mean, again, I don't have inside information. I don't know this for sure.
No,
if that's
I believe
the case,
this. I
agree
right
it's a challenge. I agree it's a challenge. I agree with Abby that I don't think The Golden Bachelor is going to be a win for Ten, if that's indeed where it's going to land or what it looks like. I think that The Bachelor franchise in its various iterations in an Australian context is largely cooked, and we can... be confident that The Golden Bachelor probably isn't going to work by having a look at how up and down this second season of My Mum, Your Dad rated for Nine, and it was very up and very down.
Mm. Well, we can just be thankful they didn't go with their original plan of The Golden Shower. All right.
Oh, no. My God. Were you holding on to that for that entire segment?
No, no, just near the end when you were talking, it came to me. Anyway, Nine News Melbourne is set for some major changes next year, with presenter Peter Hitchener being moved into the weekend shift. The beloved Hitch will be replaced by Alicia Loxley and Tom Steinfurt from 60 Minutes. Executives at Nine made the decision after 7 years convincingly won the ratings year. When rumours first surfaced in the Herald Sun a few months back, Hitch made it clear he was not ready to retire. I spoke with the man himself over the weekend and he was very upbeat, actually, saying there's plenty for him to do next year. Now, Mog, it's always dangerous making big changes like this. You know, Nine really has to make sure there isn't a backlash. If it really looks like, and look, he was moved aside, that is not in doubt. So any backlash against a headline of dumped from weeknights, he, you know, that's harsh terminology, but he has been moved to the weekends. He's such a much loved personality in Melbourne.
An icon.
There
in
could
Melbourne
be
television.
A viewer revolt if he's not treated with dignity and respect.
Yeah, and I think that ultimately that's going to come down to when he exits the regular news reading spot now, or from 24 in the weekend slot. There was certainly enough backlash that I saw in comments on posts, you know, announcing the changes from Nine, around people being a bit butthurt about the move and suggesting that he was dumped. He's moved willingly to weekends.
Sometimes when you're not given a choice, it's not like he could have said, no, I'm staying in weeknights. This idea of moving willingly,
Yeah.
You know, like...
You move or you lose your job, right? That's ultimately the situation in this situation.
The fact is, Nine have been able to get him to agree to it. This was Nine's plan. Yep. I don't want to take anything away from Hitch, but
no,
this was not of his design. If he had his choice, he'd still be reading the weeknight news. And that's fair enough, by the way. He's done an amazing job. He's led Nine to a lot of success. Obviously, they're thinking about the future, which is also fair on Nine's part. But, willingly, he's accepting it. I think there's a difference.
I agree. I think, and publicly, of course, all the PR is lovely and everyone's happy about everything and you know, long may the flowers bloom. The really interesting change in this, apart from Hitch moving to weekends, is that Nine are moving to a duo in Tom Steinfort and Alicia Loxley hosting. Now, I know in Queensland and in New South Wales, they go Sunday to Thursday as weekday and Friday, Saturday as weekend. But apparently in Melbourne, they still do it Monday to Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Yeah. So I'm not local enough to speak to that. The move for Steinfort out of 60 Minutes and into the desk next to Alicia is an interesting one because we haven't seen Tom in that mode, at least in Melbourne, but certainly we haven't seen him in that mode in some time since he's moved away from his regular stuff on Nine.
I don't think he did a lot of news reading in the 6 p.m. slot.
I think he did fill in on Today, didn't he? Or he did some stuff there?
Yes, he did.
And I think both of them are great operators and will do a fine job. Please don't misunderstand this. It's just interesting where when Melbourne and Sydney have maintained, for the most part, for their weekday broadcasts, a single host, to have Nine changing it up and putting two people on the desk in Melbourne when they're up against a single person on, you know, on 7 Melbourne, to see how that's going to go. And I wonder out loud with no previous thought if that allows Nine to hedge their bets a little bit, depending on how much they want to back in Steinfort and Loxley, that if it does go more south, and it will take some time for them to claw back their share, I appreciate that, but if it does go more south, is one of them a sacrificial lamb?
Quite possibly. Interestingly, 7 on the weekends in Sydney have Michael Usher and Angela Cox.
Yes.
In Melbourne, they have Mike Amor and Rebecca Madden. So
yes,
7 are certainly going back to that double header. It's so funny, isn't it? Because at one point, there's been a lot of double headers, not really in Sydney, but Brisbane especially, Melbourne
all the time,
to some
Brisbane,
extent.
Almost all the time.
Then it went sort of single, and now the double headers are coming back. So
but Sydney and up until now Melbourne have largely maintained for their weekday bulletins.
A version of 7 News with Dan Fullwood and David Johnson, I want to say.
Oh, I couldn't. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
That didn't work out too well, but it looks like...
Who's the 7 weekday anchor in Melbourne again? I know it's Ferguson
Peter
and
Mitchell.
Sydney. Thank you so much. And 7 have been making great strides, which is why 9 had to act. They had to do something in Melbourne to address the fact that their audience had been moving.
Yeah. Coming up, we'll meet the producers behind David Attenborough's Planet Earth 3. Plus, I almost hate to do it, but Malk and I will be picking up where we left off in our little dispute from last week because there's been a big update on the prominence debate. And we'll find out what everyone's been watching in the TV Binge Box.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Well, David Attenborough is back with Planet Earth 3, premiering this Sunday night on Channel 9 at 8 p.m. Matt Brandon is the series producer of the show, and Abby Lees is an Aussie who produced the Forest episode and has assisted on a couple of other episodes. Matt and Abby, welcome to TV Black Box.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Yeah, great to be here.
It's great to have you guys here. This is such a big show. It's Planet Earth 3. You're continuing a series that has had so much worldwide recognition. Matt, you're the series producer. Any pressure?
A huge amount of pressure, but with pressure that comes with that responsibility, it comes great opportunity. It's been an amazing journey, and it's a brilliant 8-part series. Obviously, that's in my humble opinion. a new look at the natural world.
Well, you would say that you spent 1,900 and something days filming this, or something.
That's right. The crew spent 1,904 days.
I can't believe that.
Filming, and many more traveling, and about half that again. In quarantine over the COVID period, I was reading yesterday. So it's more than 2 years the crew spent in quarantine.
I'll never forget that time through a hotel.
Well, Abby, it's great. You're an Aussie doing what Aussies do best, going to England, taking all the jobs and
doing Abby accent doing great. As well. I'm properly integrated.
I want to ask you guys, and Abby, I'll start with you and then get Matt's perspective. So I'm interested in the production process. When you say we're going to this location, okay, do you know exactly what kind of creatures what animals or what wildlife you're trying to film? Or do you say we're going to this location, these are the things on our list, but we're just going to see what we get?
I think it used to be that natural history filmmakers would probably go to a location and see what they get. Now, we really want to show a certain animal doing a certain thing, usually. And, you know, for me, I was working across the forests episode, and we want to get a really good sense of what it is to be living in forests around the world. And there are so many different habitats of forests around the world. So what we do is we do quite a lot of research beforehand and find different animals doing amazing things in different habitats across the world. And so we're there with a purpose before we go. But, you know, animals are always so surprising. What would we say? Animals write the best scripts.
Yeah, animals write the best scripts is what we'd say. So you do, there's a huge amount of research. We work very closely with scientists, experts, conservationists, indigenous peoples who live all over the world. And we work closely with them to find the stories and to isolate what we want to do. But when you arrive and you've chosen your A-list characters, your big box, it's a bit like casting for a Hollywood movie. You find different animals have different personalities. So you find your A-lister, the person that you want to be front and center. And maybe they do something that you didn't expect. And that's the real skill for the producers on the ground is deciding to maybe find a slightly different story whilst you're out there.
Yeah, when I was filming in Ecuador, we were filming these little insects, and in the corner of my eye, they're called tree hoppers, and they're tiny, really tiny. And we wanted to film a mother.
This is my point. You're going to get things the size of a small finger. And it just blows my mind that, you know, yeah, that's what we want, but then actually being able to go and find that animal. That's the thing that's blowing my mind.
Oh, we were terrified that we weren't going to find it.
right, okay.
We were told that they might be there, but we just don't know. And so there was someone that went 5 days before us to try and search for them, and they only found it the evening that we arrived as well. And he was really nervous. He went, "Oh, I've just managed to find one here. Let's go and see. So, yeah, it can be, you're on the edge of your seat.
But that was an incredible story. So these tiny little tree hoppers do something that you can't believe. First of all, they come in like 3,000 different shapes and sizes. I mean, there are many of them. And the species that Abby was filming, all of them communicate in this extraordinary way. So they communicate by
vibrating
that abdomen that goes up the tree stem or a branch, and it's audible with using special microphones, which Abby used when you're out there. And scientists will start to understand what these things mean. Some of them to say that they need food, and some of them to say there's predators coming
and to find a mate. Yeah, and there's just these mate. Amazing sort but of like courtship songs that you can't hear without this piece of equipment.
But what Abby noticed out of the corner of her eye, that not only were they communicating with each other, they appeared to be communicating with a bee, right?
Yeah, so they have this amazing relationship with another species, a bee, which protects them from predators. And in return, the bee can eat some sap, which they exude from their bottoms. But also the mum has maternal care over her young. And so I noticed one day that this flick in the corner of my eye, this ant just going whooshing past, and I realized she was kicking like a ninja ants away from her babies. And that's something that we didn't know about before we went into the field. So she was constantly surprising us, and then just seeing this interaction with the bees happening and the bees like fending off predators as well was just absolutely mind-boggling.
So that becomes a bigger part of the story. You're seeing things on location. So you've got a fixer. You're saying this is the animal we want. You've got a fixer going and looking for those so that you can just take the crew and keep your resources, you know, tight, so you're not there just trying to find something. How many crew do you have with you out there, and how many days are you shooting that sequence?
Well, I don't know how long that one took, probably about 3 weeks or something.
Yeah, around that.
About 3 weeks, but I mean, it really varies. And you know.
And are you camping? Are you going back to a hotel? How are you living?
That also varies.
That time?
We had one shoot that went out to a place called Ellesmere Island in the way north in the Arctic Circle. And they were 3 months on the island camping. The only you have to fly in, and it was an extraordinary feat, actually. When they got there, there's only one place you can stay on the island, and because of the COVID pandemic, that was shut. No one was allowed to go inside. So they camped outside, their tents blew down, they had to dig themselves up. You know, they were traveling, they were filming wolves, Arctic wolves and musk oxen, and they would have to travel huge distances. Their ATVs were getting stuck in the mud. They had to dig them out by hand because they forgot their shovels. And then at the end of all, when they were going to leave, they had to build their own runway, because the helicopters that were going to come and pick them up were diverted because there were wildfires elsewhere in the country. So they went off there. So, there's extraordinary endeavor. Another crew trekked for 2 days through the Vietnamese jungle with 500 kilos of equipment, and then to the world's, what is thought to be the world's biggest cave, where they then spent 18 days underground, the longest anyone has spent in that cave. Obviously, they were keeping as well, limited water, no way to wash. It was quite an endeavor.
But it's certainly not like a film crew. They were actually quite small, but there is a massive team behind those camera people and directors. So, you know, for Tree Hoppers, it was me and the cameraman. But then we had amazing team of people in Ecuador helping us find those insects. And so, it's certainly not like a film set, but...
No.
Yeah. Matt, it's interesting. Whenever Australia is included in these specials, we get excited. Obviously, you filmed bits and pieces in Australia. The turtles was harrowing to watch, to be honest, what those turtles go through on the Australian coast. Do you try to – I assume you go where the stories are, but are you mindful that territories where this is going certainly like to see their own stories as well?
I mean, I think it's a global series, and across you know, Australia's an amazing country with beautiful wildlife, and I mean, it's almost a difficult question, Robert, because it's a no-brainer that you would go to Australia. There are so many wonderful stories, and there's so much amazing wild habitat. And yes, the turtles themselves, that is harrowing in some respects. And very poignant, because Sir David had travelled there himself 66 years before, so there's a relevance to that story. But those stories we are trying to, I mean, there's no escaping wherever you go in the world, and that is a prism through which we look at the whole series. Wherever you go in the world, human impact can be felt by the animals that we share different habitats with. So those slightly, you called it harrowing, although it's that it, there's a.
I just remember the cuts on the fins, you know, as crawling across the rocks.
Yeah, well, they're crawling across the rocks, and that is, but they also make it back to the water, and it's a wonderful sequence actually, because that's what you're looking for is drama, relatable drama.
Well. Now you've hit on something, because how important you've got people going out and shooting the stories, but then I assume you're part of the editing process and helping with those stories, Matt. And you know, editing plays such a big role. You know, like you're seeing a predator, and you've got cutaways to fish moving away, you know, and that's helping to build the drama of the story you're trying to tell. And you even get jump scares in your sequences at times, you know. It's not just what's shot on the field, it's how it's put together, right?
Correct, it is. But we love to say that nature writes the best scripts. Everything that you see happens, we see happening. It's not so you might obviously... Editing plays a big role, but it's genuinely something that we've observed. That's a real key to the veracity of the stories that we tell, and a very important.
For me, mug of crocodiles in fresh water comes to mind, because they're just so amazing. So in Sri Lanka, there are these huge crocodiles, and they wait for the dry season, and the water holes dry up, and there's not any food around. But when prey comes down to the water to drink, they've hidden themselves, and that's their moment to finally grab some food. And you're on the edge of your seat because you're waiting for that crocodile to lash out. And know the story.
Yeah. So actually, that's a really good case in point. The what they do. I mean, first of all, it's an incredible sequence because we all have an innate fear, I think, probably of crocodiles, and we all think that they're mindless killers, and these things prove completely otherwise. They are mindful. They go there, they build these incredible traps, and they wait on the edge of these kind of shrunken water holes for the prey to come down, but then they wait and they wait and they wait, and that's what our camera person had to do. The Abdullah sat in a hide for 300 hours over the course of 2 weeks, three weeks. For the first 100 hours, nothing happened. And he had to teach himself how to micro nap whilst he was there. He had to be very careful even opening a bottle, because that would spook the prey. But the result is that when the muggers actually mug, that's why they... presume that's why they're called mugger crocodiles.
Let's say that's
they
why.
They erupt from this from their camouflage spot to grab their prey. But as I said, it took 100 hours before that happened, and that's reflected in the sequence. Obviously, you don't wait for 100 hours for something to happen, but it takes a while before you actually see it.
And there's a real tension and quietness, and I think that the editor has done real justice to what it feels like to be a prey and be a mugger. So, yeah.
Well, that's beautiful, and that's what it's about.
That is what it's about. So he was saying he couldn't understand why they didn't come out sometimes. The crocodile, it's like the prey's there, you know the crocodile's there, and it just waits. It's like, what is it, not hungry, is it? I mean, yeah.
I guess we'll never be able to get right into the mind of an animal.
Well, you get very close. You get as close as you can. Look, I've only seen two episodes. What I've seen is brilliant. We know that you guys do amazing work. Obviously, with Attenborough is just, you know, the piece of resistance. Congratulations on a great series, and thank you for joining us on TV Black Box.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
And Planet Earth 3 will premiere this Sunday at 8 p.m. on Channel 9 and 9 Now. All right. I have been a little worried about opening this Pandora's box again, but there has been an update on a story we discussed last week regarding prominence. Last week, we talked about the Astro Media campaign aimed at scaring consumers about the idea of giving free-to-air TV networks prominence on smart TVs.
Now, what we mean by that, basically, every manufacturer selling TVs in Australia would have to make 7 Plus, 9 Now, 10 Play, ABC iView and SBS On Demand the first five apps consumers would see. The Foxtel-led Astra campaign took out full-page ads saying, warning, now the government wants to control your TV. Now Free-to-Air TV has launched its own advertising campaign under the slogan, don't let big tech take away... Don't let big tech take your free away.
Terrible
it's
slogan.
A mouthful, isn't it?
Terrible slogan.
Yeah.
Don't let big tech take your free away. Catchy.
blah, 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 blah. Something away.
Tensions are so high, Paramount Plus, run by Channel 10, has withdrawn from Astra. Free TV has sent legal letters to Astra demanding the removal of the ads, claiming they are false and misleading. Foxtel has rejected the claim. Monk, I pretty much stand by everything I said last week.
Sure.
I think those ads from Foxtel are complete bullshit. Whatever your stance on the issue, no one's controlling your TV. But there was a big text thread between you and someone we both know and respect in the industry.
Mm.
I was part of that text message, but I came back to it and you guys had 53 messages between you. Am I wrong? Was the end upshot that I was right all along?
From a certain point of view, Rob.
Moving on.
No. Wow, hang on. I want to just clarify a couple of things, if I may, acknowledging all of the stuff that we've got to in this. I am very pro the free-to-air television industry in Australia, as much as I am the subscription television industry in Australia, as much as I am the streaming industry in Australia.
That's
what I want to see. I want to see good content on my screen. Give me plenty of it.
Yeah.
I acknowledge the free-to-air commercial networks are not giving us the same level of content or the same amount of content from a drama particularly point of view that they used to. They're not incentivized to do so. So why should they? I understand their argument. I acknowledge it and I accept it. That doesn't mean I agree with it. I understand what they're saying. And I also understand that the free-to-air networks are concerned reasonably that if they are not front of mind, i.e. in that prominent position on your smart TV when you buy it, that they feel they will be forgotten and therefore underutilized, and so their shares and everything will diminish, so they'll just vanish. They'll go into the night because people aren't watching them because they're going to your Netflixes and your Stans and your Prime Videos and your whatevers. I also understand, for both sides, kludgy arguments. I do understand Foxtel's perspective, particularly, and this hit me this week in reflecting on it. Foxtel at their upfronts announced, finally, Hubble, their big new, effectively set-top plug-in box and television that they're going to be launching next year. Let's just see this from their perspective. They launch a new TV, a smart TV, on the Australian marketplace, and the federal government has just legislated to say that Foxtel's new smart TV cannot have their apps first.
That's what this is about. You've nailed
it. It's just hit me this week.
You have
like
nailed
the, it. The connection
you
between
this. You have
nailed this. And I completely understand why they would have their nose out of joint about that. This is
sure,
their
but don't
product.
Give us this bullshit advertising. Like, you know what? I've been the biggest supporter of News Corp here on this podcast. I've been the biggest supporter out of everyone on this thing. But they've overreached on this issue. And I do think... Genuinely, you can't say the government's taking control of your TV. It's
The critical word is control and how you understand it. Both of the ad campaigns are not great.
They're putting some apps on that you can delete and move away. Like, seriously.
Again, we hope and understand that will be the legislation, but until it's in stone,
that's all the networks want. They're not asking for them to be stuck there that you can't. It's not like Apple downloading a U2 album onto your iPhone, you know. That's
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Not a big deal.
Is there any, and I am supportive of having the free-to-air apps first, but is there any evidence to suggest that it actually makes a difference, the order of the apps?
It hasn't been done, so we don't know.
Like, the theory, Abby, is legitimately that if they're not there when you first boot up your TV, because, look, frankly, we know that it's a small portion of the market, this guy, that are nerdy enough to go, I want to reorder the apps because I want to have these ones here and those sorts of things and blah, blah, blah. And every smart TV that comes out currently allows you to reorder your apps and do all that sort of stuff. Wonderful. Most people do not do that. So what the prominence debate leans into is if the five free-to-air channel apps, ABC through 10, are the first five in that list, they're all banking on that no one will move them, so they will always be there. So people are more likely to go, oh, what's in this, or have a look into that. I think the reality is that for most people that do use them, even if they don't move them, they're going to go, I want to go and watch show on service.
That's what I never turn on my TV. And maybe not everyone is like this, but I never turn on my TV and I'm just like, I'll click the first thing there. I always go in with a purpose.
You know, at least a service you're going into, if not a program you're going
Which is fine. Which is fine, Abby. And you can still do that. And
no, I know. I'm not against it at all. I just, I wonder if the everyone's going to forget about us and our industry is going to die is a bit overdramatic.
I don't think it is, actually, because I think that you're dealing with players with a lot of money, and you know, I'm still intrigued about the fact that ABC iView has a spot on your remote control, because they are paying for that. They are paying for that, and I think that is problematic, to be honest.
Why is it problematic, Rob? I didn't really understand why you thought it was problematic.
Well,
yeah, I don't have an issue with it.
I don't have a problem with the ABC marketing itself. But it has, by buying the space on the remotes, it's using funding that could be on content. Now, it still needs to get that content to Australians. I'm talking out loud. I don't have a definitive view.
I appreciate this is a thought in motion.
I find it problematic that they're paying above and beyond to get that prominent place on the remote. And, you know, the other thing is, Netflix and Prime Video will still be paying for those positions, so you still have fast access to those streaming services, I'm sure.
Sure, but not every remote has got those buttons, right? Some of them do.
It's only the ones who pay for it.
But not all of them. And those that enter into agreements with organisations that are willing to offer that space. The interesting thing is, Rob, that it's not a great sort of comparative same-same. The idea that the ABC have opted to pay to have a button on the remote to give them, dare I say it, prominence, is in line with this argument around them wanting to, well, not them directly, it's certainly 7, 9 and 10 pushing the barrel.
I agree with you. It is.
Who all could come up with the money to put a button on the remote so that instead of maybe being our smart app, you know, organisation, we're in front of everyone, permanently hardwired on your remote, is a button that says 7 plus 9 now, 10
sure. play. And they may elect to do that, but when it comes to having the apps there, and I go back to the analogy I used last week, it's like buying a new car. The radio stations, there are radio stations pre-programmed into the shortcut buttons on your AM, FM radio, and you can retune those, and that's what we're talking about here. I just don't think giving a slight leg up and making sure the Australian TV networks who have serviced us for over 60, almost 70 years, get a chance to survive. I don't have a problem with it.
And we are in a real breaking ground situation in that not one of our TV networks have moved into hardware until now. So with Foxtel bringing out the Hubble Puck and the Hubble Television, Hubble Glass is what they call it, this legislation could be quite impacting on their product. And I can understand that, and this is my words, not theirs. I'm certainly not a lawyer. I understand the anti-competitive nature of being told that me as a TV network making a product, a television to sell to consumers, can't have my product front and center on that because the legislation from my competitors has to put them first. That becomes a really interesting situation.
And that's why Foxtel are going hard, right? You've nailed it. It's self-serving.
For sure.
Which is fine. They're entitled to do that. And they can argue against that. Just don't use lies. Well,
I think it honestly, Robert, comes down to what we mean by control in that context. And I'm not privy to any of it.
Sounding like a lawyer, Mog.
And I like,
but that's all this is, mate.
No, no.
But, it's all legal mumbo-jumbo stuff. You see those advertisements,
they made it sound like the government would be choosing what you see. And that's just not
true. No, they said control. That's what they said.
Controlling the government, controlling your television.
It's a very loaded word. I think it was used as a scare campaign, really.
For sure. It was a scare. Both sides are coming at you with fear. Well, particularly now that they're free TV.
I think maybe I'll need to have a chat with free TV and come up with a better slogan than, what was it?
I'm really sorry, free TV. We're sorry that Rob is taking you on.
Take your free away.
It's awful.
I think they maybe tried to get freedom, but it didn't work quite the same.
It's just so bad.
They'll take our lives, but they'll never take our free TV-dom.
So even that's better. All right, here's one for you, because in the lead up to three new specials to mark the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who, the BBC aired a five-minute story as part of their Children in Need telethon event. In the special, the Doctor meets the creator of the Daleks, Davros, but before he became wheelchair-bound. And it turns out there was a lot more to this decision than you might think. Here's executive producer Russell T. Davies to explain.
We had long conversations about bringing Davros back because he's a fantastic character. Time and society and culture and taste has moved on, and there's a problem with the Davros of old in that he's a wheelchair user who is evil. And I had problems with that, and a lot of us on the production team had the problems with that, of associating disability with evil. And trust me, there's a very long tradition of this. I'm not blaming people in the past at all, but the world changes, and when the world changes, Doctor Who has to change as well.
We can evolve, we can start anew, we can become stronger.
So we made the choice to bring back Davros without the facial scarring and without the wheelchair or his support unit, which functions as a wheelchair. I say, this is how we see Davros now. This is what he looks like. This is 2023. This is our lens. This is our eye. Things used to be in black and white. They're not in black and white anymore. And Davros used to look like that, and he looks like this now. And that we are absolutely standing by.
This is the biggest load of horse shit I have heard.
Oh, I knew this was coming. Oh, my God.
Right? Abby, Davros is an iconic character in Doctor Who. He's always been wheelchair-bound. Now, when I saw this Children in Need special, I didn't have a problem with the fact they went back to a time before he was wheelchair-bound. No problems with that. I enjoyed, I genuinely enjoyed the special. But then I saw this video of Russell T. Davies saying, basically saying, we'll never see Davros in a wheelchair again because it's marginalising people in wheelchairs. And, well, we heard what he just said. But he's, I think this is the biggest crock of shit. Do you think a whole character should be changed for 2023 sensibilities on a show that's been running for 60 years?
I am very torn on this one because I really do understand and empathise with the history of the trope in media where villains are often depicted as having disabilities. There was a very beautiful campaign in the UK a few years ago called I Am Not Your Villain. I would highly, it's on YouTube, you can look it up. Amazing. Yep. Really, really touching and heartwarming. But I also think we have a problem with a lack of representation in media overall. And so I think when you're taking a character in a wheelchair and then taking them out of that.
Which isn't actually a wheelchair, by the way. It's not a traditional wheelchair that we think of.
Sure. But effectively a wheelchair. And you're taking them out of that wheelchair. I also then think you are taking away a character with a disability, if that makes sense. And I think that, so I actually don't agree that this is for 2023 sensibilities, because I think there are two different issues here where one is, yes, about the depiction of disabled people, and the other one is about representation of disabled people. And they're two different issues and they're conflicting in this particular situation. I fully support the idea that there needs to be wider representation of disabled people and
agree.
Yep, as we all do, I'm sure.
Which Doctor Who has done, by the way. And it's a recent
in other characters.
Thing, but during Jodie Whittaker's time, there was a friend of one of the companions who didn't have an arm, and it was just, you know, like it wasn't a big deal. She was just part of the story. And I loved that. I thought that was fantastic. I think he's probably got a point about the depiction of villains as having...
Absolutely has a point.
There's a butt coming, Mulk. There's a butt.
I know there is.
But there has also been a lot of some, or at least some, maybe not a lot, of positive characters. Who was the was it Ironside who was in the wheelchair that solved all the crime cases?
Yes.
The American show. You know,
I know, but we're talking about percentages, right? So while there might be some, if we're talking,
that's like, why I did qualify that.
Yeah. So there is a bigger proportion of disability representation in a negative way in the media. There just is. And so I do understand that as an issue. I think it's a missed opportunity to have. And Rob, I checked with you before we recorded tonight whether this was going to be the same actor who had always played him. You clarified that he's been played by multiple different people. I think this is actually an opportunity for an actor in a wheelchair to play this character and to have that representation. I don't think that because there's been a history of this trope that suddenly you can just make a character who was disabled no longer disabled. I don't think that helps.
I agree. I'm so with you on this.
Yeah, I just think it's a missed opportunity. I respect him trying to be sensitive and trying to do the right thing, and I don't agree with your outrage.
This just isn't the character.
No, I know, but I don't agree with the outrage over it. Like, he's trying to do a nice thing, and I don't think that we should be approaching people trying to be sensitive with anger.
I think there's so many ways of having a positive agenda. You're taking now this is an iconic character. Mm-hmm. The Daleks are the biggest monster on Doctor Who. This is the creator. There's a whole story of why he's, you know, he did the experiments and on himself and ended up in this configuration where he's half Dalek, half person, you know. So
yeah.
there's a whole backstory here. And as I said, when you went back in time and saw him before he became wheelchair bound, no problems. Genuinely, I love the story. But this idea that we're never going to see Davros again, who's been so iconic along the road with Doctor Who ever since the 70s, I don't like it. Sorry.
Can I buy into this conversation by asking some questions just to start with?
Mm-hmm.
Has Mr. Davies explained in the context of the story how they are, if at all, explaining why Davros is now walking around and not looking prune-faced?
Because we've gone back in time before he...
No. Have they explained actually the storyline narrative as to how we get to a walking Davros versus a non-walking Davros?
Well, we haven't. We've only seen this five-minute thing. I don't think he's going to use him again. My take was that he wanted Davros to be like this, which is fine if he wants to do
in
that.
In isolation,
that's
fine. In this special,
yeah,
this that, little yeah. moment...
That's fine because the story was great and it made sense. Sure. We went back in time. But I think if he's saying we're closing the chapter on such an iconic character, it's a shame. But he's also made it very clear that if the character was to come back, we won't see him in a wheelchair. And it's just like, well,
sure.
How does that work?
But it also might be another flashback, dare I say. Well, I mean, I also want to acknowledge that, A, it's fiction. Two, it's science fiction. And three, it's all made up. So the ability for a character to be retconned or whatever, it may be legitimately that they do have those experiences that I'm absolutely supposing. If Davros appears again, because the Doctor can travel through time, it might be travelling back to deal with Davros prior to whatever
got
Davros into the...
That's problematic too, because Davros has had such a history with the Doctor that means the first time he met the Doctor, he would have already known the Doctor.
To jump back into reality, however, but moments in time, right? If we've gone back to see Davros and now we can slide back into that immediate second after he was there, all the things. We saw the controversy that spun around when the Doctor was announced to be a lady.
Stupid.
For sure.
Yeah, there is going to be. But I wasn't on that bandwagon because the show had set it up. Now,
I know.
When I was a kid.
I'm not suggesting you were, Rob.
No, but I'm saying when I was a kid, the Doctor was a man. That's just how we knew him. Stephen Moffat did the greatest thing for Chris Chibnall by introducing the idea that Time Lords could change sex as part of their regeneration. He did it with the Master, who became Missy. He did it with other Time Lord characters. So when it came time for the Doctor to turn into a female, for me as a viewer, it had been explained. It made perfect sense. And so it wasn't a problem for me. Now, having said that, I know, Mark, that it was a problem for a lot of fuckwits out there. I completely get that.
For sure. And I suspect that we're going to get a Venn diagram overlap of a whole bunch of new fuckwits and some of the same fuckwits jumping up and down because the Doctor's going to be not white.
Oh, yeah, it's already happened.
Shitty Gatwa, I think, is going to be brilliant. And I'd love
phenomenal. I expect the same. I think it'd be wonderful. My family are looking forward to seeing the first of the three specials this Sunday on Disney+. am just concerned that the idea that any character in a universe, whether the show's gone for 1 year or 75,000 years, that any character, particularly in a science fiction show which deals with time, is untouchable. I don't agree with the idea. I think that I appreciate you've got to be careful because you are buying into the broader narrative and the big universe of stuff that we know, ostensibly the Bible. However, when your central character literally changes the actual full human being that they are in the person that performs them, and it's just acknowledged that in their regeneration, they are entirely a different person, and everyone just goes, cool. I don't see why your big bad can't go through some other kind of transformation, whether it is a flashback or in the present, they go through some transformation. Look, Davros is a smart guy. Who's to say that Davros didn't find out a way to fix his legs or fix his face or go to a process that solved? Like, that's what I'm saying. I get that in
no
the
legs.
Moment for that little thing. Sorry?
He has no legs.
Yeah, but we also live in a universe where you can travel through time, Rob. I'm pretty sure they can fix the leg problem.
I just think, you know what? He could have done this without making this woke political statement. I
think it's entirely reasonable explaining why he did it and acknowledging that of the time that Davros was shown to us, it was a huge trope that the bad guy was disabled and grizzled. And I'm going to tell you, it's not even then. If you remember, and it is in the last 20 years, the M. Night Shyamalan movie Unbreakable had Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson. Samuel L. Jackson was the bad guy. And he was ostensibly disabled.
It's all the time.
He had a rib. Right? It still happens.
The Joker.
All the freaking time.
Voldemort.
All the freaking
time. The witches.
Whether it's mental health issues.
It's always the same.
Or it's some kind of disability. The bad guy has something wrong with them and the good guy generally is A-OK.
Yeah.
So it's a trope that it can be seen as lazy in some situations. So I understand his desire to want to try and rectify that.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Let's open the TV binge box and find out what everyone's been watching. Abby, what have you been watching?
So Big Brother UK finished this week, which
Jordan.
I was going to say no spoilers. I won't say who won, but sure.
Am I going to have to bleep that?
And coming back in 3, 2.
Well,
no,
that's been very heavily publicised in UK press.
Also, if it's publicised, it's not a spoiler?
We can have that discussion later. We can make that next week's talking point if you like.
But I loved it.
I don't have the time or the capacity to go down that rabbit hole tonight.
Yeah, fair enough. I loved it. The top five were who I wanted to be in the top five from very, very early on. So I was really happy. I think also it's so obvious, but it made me realise that that's what happens when you have public voting in Big Brother, is that the people that you like stay to the end.
You get the right result.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, you get a result that the biggest bulk of the audience are happy
with. Exactly. So I loved it. Excited for Celebrity Big Brother UK as well, which is happening soon, I believe.
So I take it you're not watching Big Brother Australia, Abby?
I haven't. Do you know, I was going to give it a go because I thought, why not? But it's too much of a time commitment for something that I'm not that interested in. So I just decided, nah.
Sure.
Whatever, not worth it.
I'm with you.
And the other one I've been watching is just still Lost. I've fallen a bit behind. I needed to watch 5 episodes a week by the time I go to Hawaii. I did not watch 5 episodes this week, mainly because I was finishing off Big Brother. So now I am back on the Lost train on Disney Plus.
Great. Great.
I watched Guardians of the Galaxy 3 on Disney Plus. I didn't see it at the movie, so I got to see that. Got to say, I couldn't do it all in one go. I was getting a little bit bored. I walked away. I came back. I picked it up the day after. It did take me a
few... This is the man with ADHD, yes?
Yeah. That does play into it.
But there are movies that can get me to sit down for a couple of hours.
Sure.
I enjoyed it, but it didn't have the magic of the first two, I will say.
Right.
Obviously, I
would have said the third one was better than two, but fair enough, play on.
Do you know what? I could possibly go with you there, and I'm going to actually go and have another watch with my family. So yep. I liked it enough to do that.
Sure.
And my middle child is just dining out on Miranda on Stan at the moment. And so that's
good
her,
choices.
That's her Big Bang Theory. You know, she loves just watching it over and over again. And now she's walking around the house saying,
Daddy, can you do this for me, please and thank you? Good day to you. You know, all the Mirandaisms. And,
could be saying worse things.
Yeah, certainly. And so been enjoying that. Mug, bring us home. What have you been watching, dear sir?
Please and thank you, Rob. I've been watching heaps of TV, particularly some movies of late, but they're not so much the big things I want to talk about. The two that I'm going to talk about tonight, and I've got a bunch of upmulks to follow, but the two I'm talking about tonight are the first part of the final season of The Crown dropped this week, the first four episodes. Now, it is not a spoiler to talk about the fact it's the royal family and that this episode is all about Princess Diana and Dodi and her dying.
What?
Yes.
Right? That is a factual thing that took place in the real history of the world.
Is it good, Mark? Because I've got to say I've had no interest to watch this season.
Rob, after a TV binge box series a couple of years ago where Joe Casamento made us watch an episode of The Crown, I've been hooked.
Absolutely gobsmacked. I started losing it last season, though.
Yeah, I'm a season behind as well. But I would like
last season was a bit tough, but I thought came home really strong.
I think what I didn't like season, is I could tell how much they made up and wasn't true. Because
Look, I think that they have to read into a whole bunch of this stuff when they're showing private conversations that no one is privy to.
I get that. I get that. That doesn't bother me. But just some eventuality, that's not what happened. Even I knew that. And that's probably the earlier series wasn't so problematic because I wasn't around for that.
But I was just going to say, I think because I wasn't around for any of this, I still really enjoy it. And I don't know what's true and what's not. It could all be completely made up for all I know.
But we also know that for all of the seasons earlier, right, particularly with young Princess Elizabeth that became young Queen Elizabeth, there's a whole bunch of shit they had to make up in that for the same reasons, right?
Yeah.
The really amazing thing in this was I was expecting for this 10-episode final season that we would see Princess Diana pass away later in the season. I'm not going to say which episode it happens in. Holy crap. It was, I think, the right level of confronting. A little bit weird. They did throw some poetic and creative license into it with dead people appearing to alive people and having conversations with them. However, really important. I thought narratively it actually really helped bring some humanity to characters that we otherwise wouldn't consider to be as human, if you follow my
drift. Where were you when Princess died?
I was living in Kincumber on the Central Coast. I remember hearing about it and then turning on the TV and not moving from within sight of it for the next probably 18 hours.
It's one of those moments, isn't it? I was in my car visiting my parents in Minto in New South Wales and I was crossing a bridge, had the radio on and heard it and went, what? That doesn't make sense. And then it sunk in. It is one of those moments you know where you were, Abby. Yeah. I think you're too young.
Yeah, I don't know. What year did she die?
It was 97, Abby, so I imagine you're a bit...
Jesus, Rob! Rob allows to be the authority. It was 97.
He knew that off the top of his head as well. I definitely didn't Google that.
There was no edit point. There was no Google.
Sure, nothing happened. I've been fully impressed with Imelda Staunton as the Queen. And mind you, I keep looking at her and listening to her and going, when is she going to Dolores Umbridge this shit? I really enjoyed her as Queen Elizabeth. And same with Jonathan Pryce as Prince Philip. They've been phenomenal in their roles. Elizabeth Debicki as Princess Diana.
Oh, she's so good.
Really great. Really great. Affectations and everything. Some of the lookalikes are not great. I'm going to say I do like that they're trying to somewhat kind of, well, they're not trying, but to me it looks like they're trying to resurrect, you know, sort of now King Charles's early life, but... Go and do it, friends. I recommend, even if you haven't been watching The Crown, this season does stand alone in and of itself, but you get payoff from previous seasons. It's delightful. It's scary. I cried a little bit. The Crown, Part A, Season 6, is now 4 episodes on Netflix, with the final 6 episodes coming in December.
And you can even buy the props. They're selling 450 props and set pieces.
To raise money for charity.
That's cool.
You can get the carriage. You can get a copy, the copy of the Queen's coronation dress. Do yourself a favour.
I think you can buy a coffin. I don't know that for sure. I'm just making that up. The Crown on Netflix, definitely check it out. Season 6, Part A. The other series I want to talk about is about to land on Disney Plus next week, but I've been fortunate enough to get previews for it. The Artful Dodger. Now, this is a Disney Plus series made in Australia using a largely Australian cast. The premise is post-Oliver Twist. So Oliver, the movie that we know that had Fagin in it and the Artful Dodger, those characters, of course, continued on in that realm. And as it turns out, Dodger's grown up, became a surgeon, and has settled in the colonies of Australia. So here's Dodger being a surgeon. He's got his own issues. And out of nowhere, Fagin appears, played by David Thewlis, and he is so great, so great. There's some really funny moments. There's some really sharp drama. There's great performances. They've thrown some pretty good money at the sets. Tim Minchin is really good, though his accent is like he's talking through a mouthful of marbles. But otherwise, you know, Jessica DeGaux, what's her name? Miranda Tapsell.
I love her.
There's some really great Aussies in it, and as well as some good overseas peeps. I cannot recommend it. I was skeptical going into it, and I loved every minute. I had to be next on those episodes. So all, I think it's going to be 10, isn't it? No, all 8 episodes drop next week, Thursday next week on, Wednesday next week on Disney Plus. The Artful Dodger, please go and check it out, friends. It's really, really great. Quick up, Malks, to Welcome to Wrexham Season 2 on Disney Plus. Great finish. A big up, Malks, to Taskmaster UK Season 16, starring Sam Campbell and others. It's been a brilliant season. Final episode this week. That's on Binge in Australia.
With one of the worst Studio 10 guests ever.
Who was that?
Julian Clary.
Well, I can understand it, but he's been delightful on Taskmaster.
No, we love him. He's fantastic. It was a whole thing. He was put in the wrong situation. We'll talk about this another time. It's a great story.
I'm sure we can. And continuing up, Malks, for The Real Housewives of Sydney, Question Everything has really hit its straps this season. And Australian Epic, I have been surprised how much I've been enjoying that. On both of those last two are on the ABC. And, of course, The Real Housewives are over on your binges. And congratulations to John Oliver for getting the Puteki Teki up in the bird of the century.
Yes, fantastic.
Not by a little
stuff.
Bit, friends, by a fucking long way.
And they ended up with a lot of donations, which is the best kind of result.
So good.
All right, that brings us to the end of TV Black Box for another week. Thank you, Abby. Thank you, Malk. And Robbo, get fucked because you didn't show up. No, he's actually sick. I'm joking. My little joke to see if he actually listens, and I'm sure he won't, so, you know, that'll be that.
He's not on it, he won't listen.
I'm Rob McKnight, we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.